and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're featuring an event commemorating the cession, or purchase of Alaska, 150 years ago. This event took place on March 30th at the Mountain View Library and was hosted by Tundra Vision as part of their grassroots lecture series, aspiring to bring Alaskans together through history. The main speaker was Willie Hensley, who presented the story of Alaska's purchase from two main points of view, the American and the Alaska Native, with some Russian history mixed throughout. In addition to serving 10 years in the Alaska legislature, Mr. Hensley has also served on various boards and commissions throughout the state. He is currently chair of the Board of Trustees of the First Alaskans Institute and vice chair of the Board of Trustees of Charter College. Before the presentation, the Moscow Knights Trio played traditional Russian music that helped set the stage for this period in Alaskan history.
Thank you very much. Unnolot, Kuyarunga, Katirugutmani, Mountain View Public Library me unnopok. Igaluk atika kikik tarung mingurunga asin tarir mingurunga ang yakatka akpayuk asin nonkagak kikik tarung mingurunga. Kuyanne, kuyanna, manitusi. In translation, I just said good evening. I'm pleased that we're gathered here at the, you probably figured it out, gathered here at the public library in Mountain View, and that my name is Igaruk, my traditional name, name for my grandpa. My parents were John and Priscilla Hensley, my tribe is the Kekektarugmi tribe. Now, you've heard about the controversy a little bit about Barrow no longer being Barrow, but being Utqiagvik. Well, God's of you, if you have to pronounce it, is a little difficult. You know, it's a you kind of close your throat and kick some air out. That's Kikiktaruk, okay? This means a little island. Anyway, I'm very pleased to be here. I'd like to thank Kate for inducing me to come over. She's quite a hero of mine because I really love and enjoy history myself. And I think her appreciation for history is infectious. The sad truth is most of us Alaskans know very little about our own space. And I never thought that Mountain View would be the place where this interest in history would be regenerated. So it's a compliment to the community here. And if we don't know our history, how can we make decisions about our future, you know? Anyway, I think my speech is going to be a little bit too long, so I'm going to try to cut it down a little bit. Like many of us, I never had an opportunity to learn anything about me, my culture, my own community up north, our own region, you know. We were being kind of spoon-fed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs certain kinds of knowledge that totally excluded anything about who we were, about our language, our culture, our geography, our way of life, all kinds of great information that sadly we didn't absorb because it wasn't being taught. And we were being sent hither and yon across the country to high schools and the lower 48 or in urban schools or in my case in Tennessee. The reality is that our people have been here for literally 10,000 years or more. I think they dated some people to over 11,000 up in the interior. But we're here to celebrate the 150th anniversary of a significant event in our history, and that is the transfer of Russia's interest in Alaska to the United States 150 years ago. To me, in the context of time, of course, it's yesterday. When you think about the millennia that our people have been here. And so when you talk about land here in Alaska, for us, it's something of an emotional thing because you know, it's land that people have been nurtured by for a long time. They have become very intimate with that land. But in the past, in auspicious occasions like this, you know, the indigenous people are sort of in the way background. And so I'm happy to try to, you know, kind of present a little bit of a different perspective. Usually we're talking about, you know, why did the Russians sell? Why did the Americans buy? You know, what were the resources? Did they pay too much? Who were they? Who did this deal in the dead of night? I'd like to comment on my views about this whole transaction from a different perspective than you might normally get from a regular historian, okay? When I look at Alaska, and when you take my courses, we start pretty much in the around 1582 in the Ural Mountains of where this great music comes from. There was a significant battle there led by a Cossack by the name of Yermak, I'm not quite sure the pronunciation, but I think being financed by a very successful merchant and trader whose family had 10,000 employees and 5,000 serfs. His name was Stroganov, Anki Stroganov. In those days, you know, fur was quite an important product, and so the problem with fur is that they kept hunting out the fur-bearing animals. They needed more land. And so against all odds, Yermak managed to defeat a grandson of Genghis Khan named Kuchin Khan and managed to eventually take control of the Khanate of Sibir, which in reality opened up the way for Russia to go all the way to the Pacific Ocean within 60 years. And so there they were, you know, at Alaska's doorstep, okay? And so from a pure human standpoint, you know, it's quite was an amazing accomplishment on the part of the Russian people. Siberia is cold as hell. And there's mosquitoes, and there's tundra, and there's taiga, you know, and there's vast distances, and hostile people. But they managed to trek across those vast distances. And of course, they had the guns and the steel. And they used hostages of the leaders to take control. They had spies and natural enemies of certain tribes. They brought the church to convert the heathen, which in reality they were until the 10th century.
Yeah.
And so they sought new lands for the resources and new people to pay taxes, usually in the form of something called yasak, which is a tax they at one point in time had to pay the Mongols, which usually paid in fur or in grain or some other valuables. It was a sign of submission, in a sense, of those peoples that they took control of. And they also licensed alcohol as a significant source of revenue in those new territories. But what was different about the Russians is that the government was always there, unlike the American West, because they appointed a voyevoda, right? Somebody who represented the Tsar, who made sure that he got his taxes, you know, that there was some government control, and there was always a list of people who was supposed to pay these taxes. If you didn't pay it, your family did. Or if you didn't pay, you went to jail, okay? And nevertheless, Peter the Great, you know, was working hard to bring Russia into the modern world to learn sciences. And he also wanted to know whether or not Asia and America were connected or not. So the first Kamchatka expedition from about 1725 to 30, led by Bering, who was a Dane, because the Russians were inlanders, you know, they had to hire the experts who knew how to navigate, et cetera. So Bering, the Dane, was unsuccessful in that first expedition because he didn't touch land, right? Couldn't see through the fog, and he didn't go ashore, so he didn't really prove that Asia and North America were not connected. But then the second Kamchatka expedition took place, and the amazing thing about these expeditions, they had to haul everything to build the ships to the Pacific. You know, all the cannon, you know, all the materials, and just that in itself was a tremendous challenge that they accomplished. But the second expedition, of course, was, you might say, successful. And I like to say they, instead of discovering Alaska and the North American continent up there near my hometown where we were practically kissing Siberia or the Russian Far East, they found it down near Seattle, you know, off the by Kayak Island near Yakutat somewhere. And so that, of course, allowed Bering's name to be become famous. You know, but on the way back, there was a lot of scurvy. They lost about a third of their men. Sven Waxel, another Dane, was in charge, but they shipwrecked out there at the tip of the Aleutians, where Bering died. And as a consequence of that time they had to spend on that island, they had to reconstruct the ship later, but during that winter, they had to hunt to survive. And what they discovered was place was teeming with foxes and fur seals and most of all sea otters. And I wanted to bring a sea otter fur and I forgot about it. But it is absolutely lush and beautiful. You know, it was very, very valuable. Those 900 sea otters they brought when they finally made it back to Okhotsk, was a fortune. Because one of those little buggers brought 80 to 100 rubles in the Chinese market at a time when an ordinary person maybe earned 2 rubles a month. So you could literally almost buy a small farm with a skin, right? And so to me, that showed the extent to which a person might, you know, take on the challenges of a trek across Siberia, maybe fear of getting shot by an arrow or freezing to death or being shipwrecked. But if you made it home, you were pretty well off. And so I wanted to kind of point that out because that was, fur was the driver in the case of Alaska. And in the early 1800s, one sea otter was worth 10 times a beaver pelt and 40 times a sable, you know, which was the fur that was caught primarily in Siberia. Anyway, the sad truth, though, is that between 1741 and 1799 or so, the experience of the Unangan people out in the Aleutians was pretty much disastrous. A combination of war, a combination of disease, a combination of starvation, forced labor in a sense, because the Unangan were absolute miracle workers on the kayak and harpoon, the throwing stick, you know. And in reality, the Unangan people were hunting sea otter all the way down to the coast of California, to Catalina Island, in time, you know, for the Russians. Okay? And, but the formation of the Russian-American Company, I think it was 1799, actually sort of moderated the company. Instead of having some wild hunters out there on their own, there was some control, but as they like to say in Russia, God is in heaven and the Tsar is far away, right? And so sometimes people got out of hand, you know. And of course, from our standpoint, you know, the Russian presence in Alaska was a very thin thread of occupation along a coast of the Aleutians, Kodiak, around Kenai, you know, down to the southeast. And so what does it take for a European, you know, to be able to claim sovereignty or ownership? Does it take like one person, you know, planting a plaque here and there to establish that right? In any case, that's of course one of the issues that we used as arguments in our effort to get some equity later. And I do not believe that that slight occupancy and a few metal plates constituted, you know, ownership, right? And there's a question about, well, why did you take an interest in this question of who owned Alaska? Well, I left home when I was 15, 5,000 miles away to the hills of Tennessee, not far from Dolly Parton's hometown. In fact, we played football against Sevierville. I stopped in Fairbanks. I was too poor to come back and forth. And so I came home once in 4 years. But it happened to be the day that the Senate passed the statehood bill. And I was in Fairbanks, and there was this giant celebration going on. They were having parades. They had a giant balloon with a 49 star hanging on it. Somebody tried to dye the Chena River gold, but it turned green. And like a dumb fool, I kind of got excited about it. I did not know that the Statehood Act was authorizing the taking of 104 million acres of native land. you know, without compensation. Okay, had no idea. In any case, in time, I took an interest because I began to read about some villages that were protesting state selections, particularly along the highway between here and Fairbanks. And I also heard about the effort to sell some plots at the World's Fair in New York, you know, in Alaska, lands that were being claimed, that were that Native people claimed were theirs. And even though I had volunteered as at the National Congress of American Indians, I still did not understand the nature of the American Indian experience and how it impacted us. You know, because we weren't as engaged in like Indian wars as they were. We did not have the extensive reservation experience that they had, and not having been exposed to any history, any law, any policies, I really was kind of in the dark. But what saved me was one course, and I hope you take mine. But when I left George Washington University, I had a degree, but I had no skill. I had a degree in one of the most useless areas of academia, political science. You know, but I kind of made it work. I learned that there was a Congress, there was two houses, there was a judiciary. You know, and I learned a little bit of history, a little bit of economics. And when Jay Rabinowitz offered his course in Fairbanks, it was like a godsend. It was just a constitutional law course, and there was like 10 of us. Mike Bradner was in it. Kirk Wickersham was in it. And it gave me the opportunity to do some research. I'm a heck of a fan of research because it gave me a chance to go back and look at the tribal relationship with the United States, the fact that the Congress, you know, controlled commerce with the tribes, that those treaties were actually contracts that were recognized in our law, That was important to know. And I had a chance to look at the Treaty of Session to ask you, what did the Russians think they had? What did the Americans think they were buying? And what did it say about the Native people that were there? There were only less than 500 Russians at any one time. And at the census in 1868 was about 30,000. Alaska Natives, a few Creoles, and a few foreigners, and that was it, okay? In any case, I had a chance also to look at the Organic Act of 1884. The Treaty of Session didn't extinguish any of our rights to the land. The Organic Act of 1884, if anything, confirmed our rights by saying that we would not be disturbed in the use of occupation of any lands or any lands claimed by us. And when I did that research, I said, we own it all, because any lands that we claim, right? And then I looked at the provisions in the Statehood Act that authorized the sale, and there was a disclaimer clause there too, that the state would not select native lands, but there was never any definition, ever, of what constitute native lands. You know, And then looking at the history, I realized that there was substance to the notion of Aboriginal title, or what they call Indian title. You know, it's up to the Congress, but the extinguishment of that underlying title was compensable, right? To be paid for. But of course, in the case of the Statehood Act, Congress authorized the conveyance of 104 million acres of our land without compensation to the state. And so when I did my research, I realized that most of Alaska was still in Indian title, except in places like the Tongass, where actually the Indian title was extinguished by the taking of Tongass for a national forest, right? But it was compensable, you know, that is, when the Indians were authorized to sue in the Court of Claims, and later on the Indian Claims Commission, the tribe had to do two things: hire a lawyer and hire an anthropologist, right? And the lawyer's job was to determine if there was a taking, a legal, an illegal taking, and the time of the taking. And so the question is then, what was the value of the land at the time of the taking? And then the anthropologist's job was to determine the extent of use and occupancy. What did it take for that tribe in terms of acreage to make a livelihood? And of course, generally speaking, it was in the millions of acres, right? And then so you multiplied the millions of acres times, you know, how many cents an acre it was worth at the time, right? So when I did my research, I realized that, my God, this is unfair, because the Clinton Haida spent 35 years in court and they got over just $7.5 million. Not a square inch of land. And I just thought that was unfair. Totally unfair. But that was the system. Court of Claims, Indian Claims Commission. The Congress had to authorize you to go to court in the Court of Claims. But then they set up the Indian Claims Commission. But I realized that the Indian Claims Commission wasn't applicable because most of our land was not taken yet. Okay? And so the other aha thing for me was realizing that if the state made a selection of land, say, like they did at Prudhoe, so they said they wanted 500,000 acres of their allotment. And under our system, the Secretary of Interior is the one who, he signs it off, right? He's got the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, he signs off. When I realized that the signing of that interim conveyance, that is before survey, when the Secretary signed that interim conveyance, we are never going to get it back. We are never going to get it back. And so there I was, a poor student, not enough money to take a taxi to town to get a beer. I was trying to think like a lawyer. And I thought, man, we've got to stop this bugger, right? We have to stop this process if we're going to preserve our rights to the land. And of course, that's eventually what we did through what was called the land freeze, with the help of Secretary Udall, who was the Secretary of Interior, who, by the way, was a trustee for Native American lands, right? The Native Americans have only 50 million acres throughout the entire United States. It's not private land, it's trust land. It's Indian land, but held in trust by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the federal government. So I was a little bit like a crazy animal at the time, because I realized that if we didn't do anything, we were screwed. We were not going to get that land. In fact, just the idea of getting land was trying to reverse 200 years of history. You know? But that's one of the beauties of our system. You know, we have an opportunity to try to get some equity. And Udall was a Mormon and had a lot of Western history. I mean, and of course, Mormons had lots of wives, and some of them were Indian. And I think he felt that, if he let the state have the land that we were claiming was ours, that he might be violating his fiduciary responsibility, because we had some rights there. And so, thanks to him, we got the land freeze, and eventually, because the oil was found in 1968 and they needed a pipeline, it helped bring this entire issue to a head. But when we started out, we had no lawyers, we had no organization, we had no communication system, we had no money. You know, but somehow in that 5-year period between 1966 and 1971, we managed to rally the country to get an unprecedented settlement, an opportunity for our own people to have a say in their lives, you know, which we did not have before. We literally had nothing to say about anything. We had no institutions of our own. We had no cities, we had no towns, we had no boroughs, we had no nonprofits, we had no corporations, we had no housing authorities, we had no health authorities, we had nothing. But to me, it's a testament to our system that we've made the progress that we've done in all of those areas, you know, really within our lifetime. And many of you had something to do with that as well. The good news is that our laws afforded us the opportunity to get some equity. That is the notion of Indian title, the notion of compensability. You know. And because we were fighting upstream, we had to find ways to minimize the direct conflict, you know, with our own neighbors here in Alaska, which in reality also meant that we had to be willing to try something new, because Congress was not about to recreate a system that in their minds didn't work, right? That is the reservation system. And they looked at the tribes and they thought, oh, they don't have any education, they got all kinds of social problems, they have bad health, they have no economic opportunity, they don't have education. That was the kind of the Nalormi view, the sort of the Great White Father view. But if you ask the Indian, he might say, well, you know, my teeth are falling out. You know, I smoke too much. I only went to the 11th grade, and I haven't worked for quite a while. But we're still here, and we're still drumming, and we're still doing our artwork, and we still have our history and our culture and our traditional institutions, and we're happy as hell. You know, so two different views. But still, we didn't ask for the corporate structure, but we're willing to do whatever it took to get the land that our people had been allowed to live on and had provided the sustenance, the lands and the waters that had provided the sustenance for people for literally thousands of years. So if we had to take a corporation, that was part of the deal. Because as a minority, you're a supplicant. When the door shuts in Congress, you're outside and they're inside, cutting the deal. But there are lots of people to thank in that whole process. People that are long gone. People who have been forgotten, who came at key moments when it was important. And I think, most of all, I think we Alaskans kind of got our act together. At first, the pioneer types thought we were the enemy. But I think in retrospect, we all realized that we had to live together. And the good news was that there was 586,400 square miles. There was lots of land, right? And then once they found the oil, at that point, they thought, 10 billion barrels? Well, you know, money can do a lot of things. You know, it greases the wheel, so to speak. And so we found a way to take care of the state interest, the indigenous interest, the environmental interest, the energy interests, and everybody's living happily ever after, sort of. Sort of. So that's sort of my message, I guess, is that it's not everything we wanted by a long shot, but it's something. And sad to say, had we remained in Russia, we'd be able to sing real good and play a balalaika, but under their system, we would not have any interest in the land. Over there, everyone is a Russian. You have no special rights as an occupant of large territories and among the different cultures there, as far as I know. It is a fascinating story, this transaction that took place. And needless to say, the Russians thought they might lose it anyway because it was indefensible in a sense if the British wanted to take it, because they were at war with the Brits, right? You know, and they also wanted to concentrate on the Amur Valley, closer to the trade with China and Japan and India, right? And for us, it made us a Pacific power, right? Anyway, that's the message I had to give. I hope you enjoyed the story. History is fascinating. Take my course.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from Willie Hensley as he discusses Alaskan history and the 150th commemoration of the purchase of Alaska from Russia. This event was hosted by Tundra Vision on March 30th at the Mountain View Library. We return now to the discussion as Willie takes questions from the audience.
Willie, that's the best presentation I've probably ever heard.
No way.
Absolutely spectacular.
Oh, thank you.
A little concerned. The elders seem to transfer the power to you young guys. You young guys did it. What happened? What was that, my design or what?
That's a hard one. Can you hear okay? Okay. He asked what happened that we 20-somethings took this thing and ran with it. And I've never really thought about how that transpired, but I think every area, Alaska is a very, very big place and different cultures. And all I can say, I can only speak about my own experience, and I've always been thankful for the fact that after having been gone to boarding school in Tennessee, and having been gone away at the university for another, it took me 5.5 years to get my degree. When I came home, people didn't reject me. You know, they didn't think that I had changed too much to have the confidence in me. I think they knew that I really came from the sod house and dog team era, like they experienced. And in spite of having been away in school, they gave me an opportunity to lead by electing me to the legislature and giving me some stature that was helpful, you know, in trying to get this humongous problem resolved. But I had to pay a price for that. That is, I couldn't wear my hair long. I couldn't party as much. You know, I had to dress with a necktie on. You know, so I had to sort of be responsible, which was hard. Anyway, that's we communicated with our people. Remember, this all took place in a very concentrated period of time. And we didn't have enough media, we didn't have any telephones, we didn't have hardly anything to work with. And so there had to be a lot of trust between our people and those of us who were engaged from the different parts of Alaska in this process. And it hurt because we were making decisions that was going to change the lives of a lot of people. And change is hard for anybody. And so But I think it's a testament to our own people that they're willing to try to make it work. And some of them are being very, very successful. And we're even helping the pioneers out now.
any other questions? Oops, I'll get straight and then I'll come back to you.
Really, I have a question regarding the cultural subject. Mm-hmm. The proclamation that was signed by Governor Walker says that this year, commemoration, is an anniversary special time for people to be more inclusive, for the future to be more inclusive to all of us, thinking for the future. So this project that we are doing this year is a cultural exchange, cultural togetherness. Mm-hmm. And to my greatest surprise, I met a lot of challenges with the Native community, who I reached out by a lot, inviting, saying, here's my hand, let's do it together, from the stage, sharing our cultures, in order that history took place, starting from the Alaska Native act on the stage, storytelling, singing, dancing, anything, and then Russian culture, and then we're today, going to the future. I found so many challenges. What would be your awareness, feeling, or advice, or thoughts regarding this? How willing the Native community culturally to include us, not Natives, who are living today, not politically, totally people to people? What's your feeling
about that? Well, хорошо, thank you. Спасибо. Well, you know, there is, of course, a lot that binds Alaska Natives with Russia as a consequence of our shared history. I'm surprised that you're not having the success that you'd like to see, because frankly, the rejuvenation of the dance out in the Kodiak area was because they were able to find people in the Russian side who actually taught them these fabulous dances, right? And so there is a tremendous sharing of the Russian Orthodox faith, which is institutionalized really in many, many communities here. Of course, my hometown was named by von Kotzebue, who was a Russian captain, a German, but a captain of a Russian vessel, the Rurik, that came there just 200 years ago and left his name there. So there are these connections that I think should be able to be reflected in the cultural. And on top of that, of course, the reindeer industry was very, very huge. And we acquired the reindeer, from the Siberian people. They brought the first 19 over from Providenia, actually, just before the turn of the century. And it changed our lives at a time when the whaling industry was wiping out the whales that we depended on. And so there's that connection as well. So, good luck. I think it's a wonderful thing.
So I just want to go back to the past a little bit. During your presentation, you mentioned that what happened with the land claims was a result of work that people who are dead and maybe forgotten had really done. And I was wondering if one of those people would have been Nick Gray,
of course,
who was buried in our cemetery, and who worked so hard to organize the Native peoples.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that just a moment?
Yeah. I got an opportunity to know Nick. He was still around in the mid-60s, but not for very long. But he was very, very key. He understood the social problems that we had. He had his own problems too. And I don't know if this story is true, but I heard that the way Cook Inlet Native Association started was maybe our own people trying to rehabilitate themselves from alcohol and used to meet, you know, to share their stories and strengthen their resolve. But Nick traveled, you know, to Bethel to help organize there, up to Fairbanks. And his brother actually was married to the daughter of the lady who delivered me, Blanche Lincoln. Her husband's name was Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, when the missionaries showed up in Kotzebue in 1897, they were Quakers from Whittier, California, from Nixon's hometown, which is quite interesting. They couldn't pronounce, so they started, you know, when you get converted, it's an opportunity to get a new name, right? It was the same in the Russian era. And so I personally knew Robert E. Lee, and George Washington, and Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. Yeah, he was a great influence in those early days. Because our own people were not accustomed to taking on the government. In fact, we were specifically saluting the flag dutifully every morning at school. And the missionaries asked us to pray for those in power. You know, so there was people. So the idea of taking on authority was not exactly part of our makeup. You know, so it was a hard thing to try to do a battle with both the state and the federal government at the same time. Oh, my last and parting remarks are, I love to needle the businessmen, Governor Sheffield, of that era who fought us so vehemently through the Chamber of Commerce. If you look at the old clippings, you'll find where I was kind of jabbing at the business community, because they never saw the opportunity. They thought we were the enemy. But the reality is that had we been able to get together, we could have had another 50 million acres that all of us could be enjoying. Now it's locked up in a park. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. This lecture, entitled Two Views of the Alaska Purchase, was presented by Tundra Vision. The event featured Willie Hensley, who presented the story of Alaska's purchase from two main points of view, the American and the Alaska Native. This event was held at the Mountain View Library on March 30th. I'm your host and producer for today's program, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.